This episode of Court Junkie is sponsored by Smokeball, a law practice management software company that you will absolutely love, especially if you work for a law firm. I know I have a lot of people in the legal field who listen to this podcast, which is awesome, and I think you're going to really like this. Smokeball is the only case management software that automatically records your time and activity for you, which is why the most profitable small law firms use Smokeball to stay organized, improve productivity, and increase profitability. Get daily digest updates, law firm insights reports, automatic Word to PDF creation, over 14,000 automated legal forms, dedicated account management, and much more. And now, Court Junkie listeners can receive 50% off the onboarding fee when you sign up with Smokeball. Just visit smokeball.com/court to get started. That's smokeball.com/court to learn more and schedule your free demo. This episode is also sponsored by Everly Well. Finding the time to get a lab test is almost impossible, but now it's easy to order the tests you want at everlywell.com. Everly Well is an at-home health testing company that offers a variety of physician-reviewed private tests, from food sensitivity to metabolism to thyroid. No more sitting in waiting rooms or waiting on your results. Head on over to everlywell.com and use promo code JUNKIE to take 15% off your first order. Everly Well, your test on your time and on your terms. Now, on to today's episode. 38-year-old Darren Sharper was stone-faced as he left a Los Angeles courthouse with his attorneys on February 19, 2014. A cameraman for the celebrity gossip site TMZ shouted out questions as he walked by.
Do you guys think prosecutors are playing fair with you guys?
Yeah.
What do you guys think about these rape allegations? Do you think this is all just a big misunderstanding? Is there anything to say to the accusers, sir? Or any of your fans in support?
Darren didn't respond. The month prior, news had hit that there was a warrant out for the once popular former NFL star's arrest. He was being accused of drugging and sexually assaulting two women. But his problems were only just beginning. Before we get started, I want to caution that this case deals with sexual assaults, and therefore, any first names of the victims I use have been completely made up in order to protect the victims' identities. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 54. A few months prior to Darren's court appearance, on November 7th, 2013, a woman whom we'll call Jane, accompanied by her family, walked into the North Hollywood police station to report a sexual assault. She told investigators that about a week prior, on the night of October 29th, 2013, she and a bunch of friends were out partying in West Hollywood when she was introduced to a man named Darren Sharper through a mutual friend. At about 2 a.m., Darren asked her if she would go with him to his hotel so he could get something. She agreed, and so she, along with a friend of hers, went with Darren in an Uber to the Century Plaza Hotel where he was staying. When they got to his hotel room, Darren poured Jane and her friend a drink and insisted that they drink it. She said she was under the impression that they were going to go to an after party. She said she went to use the bathroom and then couldn't recall anything else that happened after that. But at about 8:30 in the morning, Jane said she woke up in Darren's bedroom, naked, with Darren on top of her, having sex with her. She said she still felt groggy, and she told him that she had to leave, but he kept doing what he was doing. Her friend knocked on the door, and Darren got off of her. She said she was finally able to get up, get dressed, and leave. Later, Darren texted her to see if she made it home safely. About 3 days later, Jane decided to go to the urgent care center. They told her that they couldn't help her and instead directed her to a hospital, but she didn't go. Jane told the investigators that her friend also thought that they had been drugged with something. But despite Jane having identified Darren, the investigation seemed to be put on the back burner. 2 months later, on January 16th, 2014, two Los Angeles police officers responded to the Santa Monica Rape Treatment Center for a call of a sexual assault investigation. When they arrived, they met with a woman named Jenny, who said that two nights prior, on January 14th, she and a friend went to the Roosevelt Hotel for the Sports Illustrated 50th anniversary party. They had two vodka drinks and then left the hotel for a nightclub. When they got to the nightclub, they met a guy named Darren Sharper, with whom they had mutual friends. Darren offered to give them a ride to an after party they were all going to, and so at about 2 a.m., they got into the car that was waiting for them and went to a house party in the Hollywood Hills. They stayed there until 3:40 a.m. Darren then invited them to another party, but said he had to stop by his hotel and pick something up first. They then went to the Century Plaza Hotel, and when they got to Darren's hotel room, they both went into Darren's bathroom. When they came out, Darren had poured them two vodka and cranberry shots. They initially declined the shots, but Darren kept asking them to take them. Within 10 minutes, Jenny blacked out. At about 9 a.m., they woke up on a pullout bed in the living room of the hotel room. Jenny was sore and said that it hurt when she urinated in the bathroom. Both women's clothes were still on, but they couldn't remember anything that had happened. They left the hotel room without seeing Darren and took a cab home. Later, the two women met up again and decided to get tested at the Santa Monica Rape Treatment Center because they believed that they had been sexually assaulted. When the arrest warrant for Darren was issued 2 days later, on January 18th, 2014, Darren was quick to deny the allegations, saying that he had only met one of the women accusing him, and that they had in fact gone back to his hotel room to hook up. But the entire encounter was consensual, he insisted. And many of his fans seemed to believe him. Darren had played in the NFL for 14 years, most notably on the Green Bay Packers, the Minnesota Vikings, and the New Orleans Saints. In his last year, while playing for the Saints, he helped lead them to their first Super Bowl victory. It was 2010, Super Bowl 44, when the Saints beat the Indianapolis Colts, less than 5 years after Hurricane Katrina had hit, causing massive damage to the city.
All right, guys, we've moved things inside the Saints locker room. Joining me, I'll say he's a very happy Darren Sharper. You pretty happy right now?
I am jubilated, excited, ecstatic, all the adjectives you want to use. Find them, look them up in the dictionary, put them how I feel right now.
You know a lot of guys who play their whole careers and never win one.
I know.
What a relief it is for you to get this, huh?
I guess you could say that Darren was somewhat of a hero in New Orleans.
Darren Sharper had a number of interceptions and touchdowns playing as a safety on the way to the championship run that obviously before kind of the full truth came out had him reach a level of fame and certainly was a sports hero.
That's Ramon Antonio Vargas. He grew up in the New Orleans area and currently works as a reporter with the New Orleans Advocate. He covered the Saints back in 2013 and 2014 and was very familiar with Darren and his reputation.
He was well liked. I mean, he was charming on television, and I mean, no question, he was held in high regard for his accomplishments on the field before everything came out.
Darren retired from football after his 2011 season. And while many football players leave the world of football completely when they retire, Darren had remained in the public eye, securing a gig as a commentator and analyst on the NFL Network. Darren was pretty involved with charities too, especially charities involving women. In 2011 and 2012, he hosted the Football Camp for Her, which aimed to teach women about football. Proceeds of the camp went to benefit a breast cancer charity. Darren was also featured in a league book called NFL Dads Dedicated to Daughters, a book organized by a national violence prevention organization. Darren appeared with his daughter in the quote, "My daughter makes me mindful of how women are treated, undervalued, and exploited, which is why I feel compelled to take advantage of this opportunity to speak up about domestic violence." But despite his good guy public persona and charity work, just a few days after the arrest warrant in Los Angeles was announced, another bombshell dropped. Darren was currently out on $200,000 bail, but prosecutors filed a motion saying that they wanted to raise it. In a court filing submitted by the District Attorney of Los Angeles, they requested Darren's bail amount be increased to $10 million. And as for the reasons why, because they claimed Darren was a serial rapist. In the court filing, it was revealed that Darren was a suspect in 7 different rapes, having occurred within a 5-month time span from September 2013 to January 2014 and spanning over 4 different states in Los Angeles, California, Tempe, Arizona, Las Vegas, Nevada, and New Orleans, Louisiana. According to the filing, the incidents are as follows. On September 22, 2013, a woman we'll call Jill, a former New Orleans Saints cheerleader, said she met Darren at an event for the Saints football players. After the event, Jill and Darren went to a bar where Jill drank a beverage given to her by Darren. She blacked out and woke up the next morning around 10 a.m. with Darren on top of her, sexually assaulting her. The next day, Jill went to the University Hospital, where she underwent a sexual assault exam. Police in New Orleans investigated, and although they were able to corroborate Jill's story, Darren's DNA was found on her body, witnesses and video confirmed that the two were together that night, the district attorney's office decided to hold off on pressing charges. Later that month, on November 21st, 2013, Darren was in Scottsdale, Arizona, when he met up with a woman named Mary that he had been talking to for the last year or so. Mary, her friend Katie, and Darren were out at a nightclub drinking when Mary started acting strangely, falling asleep at their table and, quote, unable to carry a conversation. When Katie brought it up to Darren, she noted that he wasn't concerned and said that Mary was just excited that he was in town and had drank too much. Katie and another friend eventually took Mary back to her apartment. Darren came with. Katie and her friend put Mary in her pajamas and brought her to bed. Mary's roommate Michelle then woke up and joined Darren and Katie in the living room. Michelle had been at work that evening, so hadn't joined them at the club. She was completely sober. Darren gave them shots, and moments later, Katie blacked out. The next thing she remembers was waking up on the couch at about 8:35 a.m. After Michelle had taken her shot, she began to feel strange and disoriented, so she decided to go to her bedroom to lie down. She described feeling dizzy, like the room was spinning, and she found it difficult to speak. She said she was scared and was crying, so she called her boyfriend to ask what she should do. He suggested splashing some cold water on her face, and so she got up and went to the bathroom. While on her way there, she saw Darren on top of Katie on the couch, having sex with her. She said she was concerned that Katie was sleeping, but was afraid to intervene. She went back to her bedroom, locked her door, and eventually fell asleep. When Mary woke up in the morning in her bed, she was naked from the waist down. Her underwear and pajama shorts were lying on the floor next to her bed. She had no memory of the night and no memory of how her clothes had come off. A little while later, Mary dropped Darren off at a restaurant called the Breakfast Club. By that time, she had talked to Katie and Michelle, who had told her that Darren had had sex with Katie. She asked Darren why they would be saying that, and Darren replied, "I don't really remember. I guess I could have done that. I'm really sorry." Later that day, all 3 women went to get sexual assault exams done. 2 of them had been assaulted, but all 3 believed that they had been drugged. They reported the incident to police. As part of their investigation, police collected the cup that Darren provided the shots in, which tested positive for the presence of Zolpidem, also known as Ambien. But still, no arrests were made. On January 15, 2014, the day after the incident in Los Angeles at the Sports Illustrated party with Jenny, a woman named Jessica, along with her friends Lisa and John, met Darren in Las Vegas at a nightclub. Darren invited the 3 of them to an after party in his hotel room. When they got to the room, the 3 friends noticed that no one else was there. Darren provided shots, and moments later, all 3 of them blacked out. When Jessica woke up, she was next to Darren in his bed. When she got up to use the restroom, she noticed visible injuries on her face that she didn't remember getting. She returned to the bedroom and fell back asleep. When she woke up again, Darren asked her how she was feeling because he said she had gotten sick the night before and had vomited. He then gave her an unknown beverage that he said would help. The next thing she remembered was Darren sexually assaulting her. When Lisa woke up, she was alone on the hotel living room couch. She immediately felt as though she had been sexually assaulted. And John later told police that after taking the shot Darren gave him, his next memory was sitting alone at the hotel bar, with no memory of how he had gotten there. Later that night, both women went to the hospital and underwent a sexual assault examination. On February 20th, 2014, Darren pleaded not guilty in the two separate cases in Los Angeles, where he was charged with 7 felony drug and rape counts. It was here that Los Angeles prosecutor Stacey Okenweis told the judge that she had also recently learned that Darren was being investigated for a possible sexual battery incident in Miami Beach, Florida, too, where Darren currently lived. Okenweis said that listening to the interviews with these women was like listening to the same person over and over again. In each instance, Darren gave them drinks, they passed out, and then had no recollection of what had happened that previous night. She noted that Darren had a prescription for Ambien and that he had it filled 3 times within the past 2 months. He went through 70 Ambien pills in 65 days and had 20 pills on him when he was arrested on January 17th. In response to the prosecution's request to raise his bail, Judge Renee Korn raised it from $200,000 to $1 million. She also ordered Darren to stay away from nightclubs or bars and to not be alone with any women he doesn't have a previous relationship with prior to October 30th. Darren paid his bail and was released once again, but he wouldn't be free for very long. A week later, on February 27th, 2014, Darren turned himself in to the Los Angeles Police Department after police in New Orleans announced that they were wrapping up their investigation and that they, too, now had an arrest warrant for him. They were looking to charge him with the aggravated rape of 2 women in New Orleans, both from the night of September 22nd and morning of September 23rd. According to police, they had been investigating one complaint and then recently learned that another woman had also been a victim that same night. They also announced an arrest warrant for one of Darren's friends, 26-year-old Eric Nunez. According to a department spokeswoman, quote, new information uncovered also indicates that Nunez allegedly raped both women at that same location. In light of the arrest warrant, Darren was officially fired from the NFL Network. And as for the charges, in addition to the woman we're calling Jill, that former Saints cheerleader who had hung out with Darren on September 22nd, went back to his hotel room, drank a beverage he provided, and then woke up to Darren having sex with her, another woman also said that she had a similar experience that night, later, after Jill had gone to sleep. According to the arrest warrant, an acquaintance of Darren's who had a key to his apartment in New Orleans told police that he arrived after the alleged rapes had occurred. He said when he entered the apartment, he saw Darren standing there in boxer shorts. He then saw Darren's friend, Eric Nunez, come out of Darren's bedroom, also wearing boxer shorts. The warrant then goes on to state that Darren and Eric had essentially told other people about the rapes. Quote, through further investigation by the detectives, it was learned that Nunez and Sharper admitted to other known witnesses that he and Sharper had vaginal and/or oral sex with the victims, without their knowledge or permission. Eric Nunez, an NFL events promoter and server at Morton's Steakhouse, appeared in court and was freed on $400,000 bail. At his bond hearing, prosecutors said that Eric had been linked by DNA evidence to one of the women who had been assaulted, and that he had tried to reach out to both women in what the prosecutor called an act of intimidation. As a result, a protective order was issued so he could no longer contact their accusers. Darren, meanwhile, was held in custody without bail while he awaited his indictment in New Orleans. But the indictment didn't come in time. The judge in the case had given the New Orleans prosecutors a deadline to file charges, or Darren would be released on his initial bond in the Los Angeles case. The judge said that it was grotesquely unfair to continue holding Darren on just his arrest warrant, so time was ticking. But even if New Orleans wouldn't move on the indictment just yet, authorities in Arizona did. A couple weeks later, on March 12, 2014, Darren was indicted in the Arizona case, charged with drugging three women and raping two. At a hearing where Darren's attorneys were fighting to have him released on bond, a Tempe, Arizona detective testified that Darren's semen was found on the leggings of one of his alleged rape victims, and that there was a partial DNA match to Darren on the woman's genitals. Darren was denied bail and would remain in custody. This case gets even more complex, with even more accusations, which we'll get into right after this quick break from our sponsor. Driven by the mission to provide a better place to sleep for everybody, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand that is also socially conscious. In fact, for every 10 mattresses Lisa sells, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. They also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. I just love that. Not to mention, with a patented universal adaptive feel, Lisa is designed for all types of sleepers and features three premium foam layers, including 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure, which works for sleepers of all sizes. And now, Lisa is continuing to expand its offerings to include the Lisa pillow, blanket, foundation, and frame. No wonder it's a Forbes top 20 startup to watch. Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free, available in the US, UK, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping. This 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City and Virginia Beach, and over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. For Memorial Day, get $160 off when you go to leesa.com/junkie. That's $160 off when you go to leesa.com/junkie. In December 2014, Darren was finally indicted on the charges out of New Orleans. Two counts of aggravated rape and one count of simple rape. Eric Nunes was indicted on charges of aggravated rape and one count of obstruction of justice for allegedly deleting text messages. But that wasn't all. In addition to Darren and Eric Nunes, there was another accomplice named in the indictment, a 29-year-old St. Bernard Parish deputy named Brandon Lishardi. Brandon was a sergeant who worked in the traffic division in a suburb of New Orleans when he was reassigned after the investigation began. He was being charged with three counts of human trafficking, one count of aggravated rape, battery with a dangerous weapon, and obstruction of justice.
Brandon Lishardi was a deputy at a sheriff's office in a suburb of New Orleans. His father was the second in command of that agency and certainly had a measure of power because of that. That certainly allowed him, and he was basically working a security detail at a bar that Darren Sharper, the celebrity bartender at. And so they kind of hit it off, and certainly authorities' theory was that he was right there running the basic scheme, which was drugging the drinks of the victims, and then sort of and really this was the term that was kind of used as they laid out their theory, in effect serving them up for Darren Sharper to then assault.
Both Brandon and Darren were also being separately indicted on federal drug charges, alleging that they used drugs on women with the intent to commit rape. They were also charged with tampering with a witness and obstruction of an official proceeding. According to a statement from the prosecutor, quote, As alleged, Sharper and Lashardi conspired to distribute narcotics to several women with the intent to commit rape. Lashardi further compromised his position as a law enforcement officer by encouraging a witness to lie about his involvement in this conspiracy. As a result of today's federal and state charges, both Lashardi and Sharper will now be brought to justice in this district. At a hearing on December 19, 2014, some pretty horrifying details came out about the investigation, particularly about incidents that occurred in New Orleans and Las Vegas. According to FBI Special Agent Robert Blythe, Brandon Lashardi told investigators that at a football convention in Las Vegas, one of the football players there, and he couldn't recall which one, told him that the drinks had been spiked with drugs. They called the drinks, quote, horny juice. Yet Brandon didn't tell police in Las Vegas. Agent Blythe also said that Brandon was concerned about text messages on his phone, including one from Darren, which read, quote, she's on the potion, she's ready. Officer James Laney testified that in November 2013, Brandon was at a New Orleans bar when he gave a drink with drugs in it to a woman there. The woman immediately got sick. She went to the bathroom, vomited, and passed out. When she woke up, the bar was empty and she was locked inside. And while many in the sports world and beyond were reeling from the ongoing allegations against Darren and his associates, many also wondered how it had gone undiscovered for so long. CBS News conducted an investigation that concluded that there were many missteps in the investigation into Darren Sharper that may have allowed him to be a predator for years, unnoticed. Even as far back as in 2011, 3 years before Darren's initial arrest, police officers in Miami Beach responded to a rape crisis center where two women claimed that Darren had sexually assaulted them. In the report, the officers wrote that one of the nurses at the center, quote, did not find any evidence of sexual battery, and so there was no probable cause to make an arrest. But when CBS News interviewed that same nurse, she told them that she would never say that, that it's not her role. A spokesperson for the rape center also told CBS News that their protocol is to provide evidence to the crime lab without rendering an opinion on whether a crime was committed. And police officers in New Orleans may have also made mistakes in their investigations. The lead detective in the Darren Sharper case, Derek Williams, was placed under administrative investigation after a report was released by the New Orleans Inspector General. The report found that 97% of Detective Williams' cases had no documentation of any follow-up investigations after the initial reports were made. And in a collaborative piece by ProPublica, Sports Illustrated, and the New Orleans Advocate, they also concluded that because Darren had committed his crimes in multiple states, and because none of the investigators looked to see if there were any prior victims, Darren was allowed to continue with his crime spree.
There's no question that his attacking across state lines in a short amount of time complicated investigators' efforts. And for one main reason, because, you know, police in New Orleans are investigating a complaint that he assaulted two women at his condo on one night, right? And then separately from that, without realizing this, the police are also investigating complaints in other states and don't realize that those are, you know, that they've been made, right? And mostly it's because they hadn't availed themselves to this database that they have the authority to enter information to, that they have the authority to mine for information. You know, it kind of recognizes that, many sexual offenders, reoffend and do so more than once. And I think it's really to kind of be like, okay, let me get this person's name and see if his names have shown up in any other complaints. And really his quote unquote downfall, if you will, is that he did two attacks in LA and the victims in both of those cases ended up filing a report. And so the detective in that jurisdiction ended up, when he heard the report about the second one and heard who it involved and kind of what the MO, if you will, involved was, it's like alarm bells went off and it's like, wait, hold on. you know, this isn't the first time I'm hearing this about this person. If you grab them in isolation, right, okay, like, you know, one person in Tempe and one person in Las Vegas and maybe two people in New Orleans, right, you know, isolated paints a different picture than when you take all the statements from all nine people across all jurisdictions, and it all of a sudden, like, their cases become stronger by virtue of the existence of the others. It was really after the word got out about the, you know, the LA arrest that, you know, New Orleans finds out, oh my God, we have a similar complaint. And Nevada, oh, we have a similar complaint. And Arizona, we have a similar complaint too. It was really once that word got out and they started talking to each other that they realized that they had a much stronger case than they realized. And it happened, you know, unfortunately for, you know, for the victims involved, it happened after it all been attacked. And so that was it. I mean, really what turned the tide was when the agencies started talking with each other and really it was a national database that authorities are empowered to use that they just weren't using, and weren't talking with each other until, you know, several months into the spree.
The national database that Ramon is referring to is called VICAP, Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, which works in conjunction with the more well-known CODIS database. What VICAP does is it maintains a nationwide data information center that collects details of different crimes of violence. Then, VICAP analysts can examine the data and patterns to identify potential similarities among crimes. They can also develop timelines and identify homicide and sexual assault trends and patterns. If any of the departments had checked to see if Darren had been a sexual assault suspect in any other cities, they undoubtedly would have come across his pattern of abuse, all readily there for them in that database. Not only that, but the article in ProPublica points out that even a simple call to police in Miami Beach, where Darren had listed his permanent address, would have given them details about those 2011 accusations. But it wasn't until January 2014, when Darren was accused in Los Angeles, that police started making the connections. And if that wasn't all, a reporter with NPR detailed more missteps, this time by police in Florida, saying that in Miami Beach, although the women in that case went to the hospital and underwent a rape examination, that rape kit was never sent to a lab for testing. And in fact, it had been destroyed about a year later. The investigation closed. Another question is, could Darren's celebrity and status have played a role? Reportedly, in the New Orleans investigation, the case stalled because the prosecutor wanted rock-solid evidence because Darren was so high-profile. But if he had been just a regular civilian, would he have been arrested a lot sooner? In March 2015, authorities in Las Vegas finally announced their charges against Darren, two sexual assault charges. But just hours after that announcement, Darren seemed to have a change of heart. His attorney, Blair Burke, told reporters that Darren would agree to a global plea deal in all four states, Arizona, California, Louisiana, and Nevada. The deal would also work in conjunction with a plea deal for the federal charges. So Darren pleaded guilty to sexual assault and attempted sexual assault in Arizona, guilty to attempted sexual assault, a reduced felony, in Nevada, no contest to the charges in California, and guilty to one count of simple rape and two counts of forcible rape in Louisiana. In the federal case, he pleaded guilty to one count of conspiracy to distribute drugs to commit rape and two counts of distributing drugs to commit rape. As part of the deal, Darren would be sentenced to 20 years in Louisiana and California, which, with good conduct and credit for time already served, would total about 9 years. He would be sentenced to 9 years in Arizona and 8 years in Nevada. And as part of the deal, all prison terms would run concurrently, meaning that he would be serving them all at the same time and not one after another. So he was looking at about 9 years total. The plea agreement stated that the federal judge was expected to issue a 9-year sentence on the federal drug conspiracy and distribution charges as well, and that would also run concurrently. Darren would serve out his sentence first at a federal facility, and then any balance of his sentence would then be served in California. Once his sentence was completed, he would be admitted to supervised parole in California for 3.5 years, where he would register as a sex offender, wear a GPS ankle monitor, undergo sex offender treatment, drug testing, and pay restitution to his victims in Los Angeles. He would be banned from drinking alcohol, from entering any business whose primary purpose is to sell alcohol, from viewing pornography or using any electronic devices, including computers or phones, for, quote, any purpose that might further sexual activity. After serving out his parole in California, he would then immediately turn himself in to the Arizona Department of Probation, where he would be on probation for the remainder of his life. He would have to register as a sex offender, attend sex offender meetings for 2 years, and submit to polygraph tests. He would be banned from drinking alcohol, owning weapons or controlled substances without a prescription, and would be subject to search and seizure without a search warrant. And he would be subject to something else, specific to Arizona, something that is no doubt controversial.
Right, there was some language in the memorandum of understanding that kind of laid out the terms across all the jurisdictions that he would be subject to being monitored with a device called a penile plethysmograph. And really it's something that it's particular to Arizona, and it's a device that supervised the supervised release program in Arizona has the option of using for sex offenders, right, which he was going to have to register as. There's no real kind of non-graphic way to describe what the device does, but I mean, it essentially, it's like a ring, right, that you put around the base of the offender's penis, really, and they show them pictures of, you know, if it was like a pedophile, you know, show them images of that, or if it's like a rapist, show them pictures of like violent, you know, sexual acts or assault, and it's a way to kind of gauge rehabilitation, right? Because what the device does is it really gauges changes and change in pressure, really, and I guess engorging and I guess really arousal, right? Just depending on the physical things that happen when a man is aroused, and then 10 years in to supervised release, is this person closer to no longer kind of being turned on by whatever this image that we're showing them is, right? And so it's kind of a very controversial kind of device. For whoever's like analyzing the result can make a call about whether, you know, how far along someone's come in their, you know, rehabilitation and during their supervised release.
Not every county in Arizona uses the penile plethysmograph, or PPG. And in fact, the largest counties no longer do. So Ramon isn't sure if Darren would ever actually be subjected to it, but he said it might be more of an attempted illustration that the terms of his probation were strict.
It more served as an illustration of how difficult supervised release could be in the Arizona jurisdiction. And I think it was included because certainly authorities were sensitive to being perceived as having cut a celebrity with deep pockets a break, right? That either they didn't take him to court because they were worried about being able to defeat, you know, someone that on paper should have resources, right? Because they're a Super Bowl champion and they were an all-pro football player and they're a celebrity. And I think they were sensitive to either being seen as being scared or to take him to trial or being seen as cutting him a break. He's a connected guy and whatnot. And so I think, I mean, certainly whenever you were having discussions about the asking, you know, officials and agencies about, you know, whether his plea deal was lenient, there was a lot of what we're talking about. Like he might have to put that thing on himself, you know, and he might have to look at these horrible pictures and then, you know, they'll gauge whether it arouses him, you know, and I think that was kind of pointed at as like, this isn't going to be a walk in the park. And obviously if he violates any terms of it, you know, he could go back for the balance of the sentence. He could go back to the, he could certainly get his parole revoked and then face more time. And so it was kind of used as a like, this isn't going to be easy. Look at this terrible, right? Like who would want to do that? Like, how can you say that at any moment he could be hooked up to that thing?
Without the plea deal, Darren would have been facing much harsher punishments. Life in prison without the possibility of parole in Louisiana, and 33 years in Los Angeles, if convicted.
The upside for authorities to it was that, they preferred that than having to, you know, bring in several victims from out of state to different ones and kind of go through it and have, you know, have trials in separate parts of the country. I think this was just a way to kind of pocket a conviction and without the logistics of having to have try him in so many different jurisdictions.
During his federal hearing in March 2014, the judge asked him, "Are you pleading guilty because you are in fact guilty?" And Darren replied, "Yes, ma'am." According to a court document filed in the case, known as a factual basis, here is what the government would have proved had they gone to trial. That in February 2013, Darren and Brandon Lasciardi were acquaintances who were aware that each were providing controlled substances to unsuspecting women and then having sexual relations with them without their consent. Brandon was employed as a deputy sheriff with the St. Bernard Parish Sheriff's Office. On February 1st, 2013, Victim 1 was working as a model for the sponsor of a Super Bowl party in the French Quarter in New Orleans, where she met Brandon there. Brandon put ecstasy, Xanax, and Valium into her alcoholic beverage without her knowledge. He then brought her to Darren's condo, where he had sex with her. Darren then attempted to have sex with her, but didn't. Darren was aware that she had been drugged. The factual basis also gave more details about that night of September 22, 2013. In addition to the woman we called Jill, the former Saints cheerleader who was drugged and then raped at Darren's condo, another victim was also drugged and raped that night at the condo. Both women were given Ambien and ecstasy in their drinks, and then both Darren and Eric Nunez had sex with both of them. One of Jill's friends, who also knew Brandon and Darren, called Brandon later that night, saying that he had seen Jill leave the club with Darren earlier and that she had appeared to have been drugged. He knew that Brandon was a law enforcement officer and asked him to go to Darren's condo and check on her. So Brandon, in his police vehicle, went to the condo, and although he was aware that Jill had been drugged and raped, he assured the friend that everything was okay. Both women's hair was tested for drugs and tested positive for Valium, Xanax, and Ambien. And if the case had gone to trial, an expert would testify that these particular drugs are used as date rape drugs and can cause victims to have blackouts, memory loss, and an inability to make rational or reasoned decisions. Ingestion of these drugs can also cause a loss of social restraints and cause the victims to engage in sexual behavior in which they would not normally engage. Darren's DNA was also found on Jill's jeans that she had been wearing that night, and also on her genitals. And cell phone evidence showed that Darren and Brandon were together at Darren's condo when the incidents occurred, along with video surveillance from his condo, showing Darren, Eric, and the two victims arriving there that night. The prosecutor told the judge that as part of the plea deal, Darren had agreed to assist in the investigation against his co-defendants, Eric Nunez and Brandon Lasciardi. But in February 2016, Darren got quite a shock when the federal judge rejected the plea deal in his federal case. U.S. District Judge Jane Malazzo said at a hearing that the plea deal wasn't in line with federal sentencing guidelines, which would give Darren a sentence of 15 to 20 years. She called the 9-year sentence inappropriate and said she could not accept the plea agreement. Judge Malazzo also referenced a pre-sentencing report that noted that there may have been up to 16 victims, even though Darren hadn't been charged with all of them.
Basically, the options that the judge had by the nature of the plea deal was to either thumbs up or thumbs down. I mean, essentially, you know, it's probably when people heard about the terms, she had the same reaction that a lot of people had. Like, you know, 9 years, are you kidding me? When you look, when you break down the math of just the numbers involved in the case, right? I mean, that's, you know, 1 year per victim. And those are just the charged victims, right? There's a number of other uncharged allegations that were involved in the several more women that were centered to the case. But, and so she just rejected it as inappropriately lenient.
Judge Malazzo told Darren that he could withdraw his plea and take his chances at trial or strike a new plea deal. So Darren's attorney struck a new deal with the prosecution. Under the new agreement, Darren would serve 15 and a half to 20 years in prison. Judge Malazzo accepted the new agreement, but still warned Darren that his final sentence was up to her. Meanwhile, Darren's co-defendants, Eric Nunes and Brandon Lishardi, also struck plea deals. Brandon pleaded guilty to 3 counts of human trafficking and 1 count of forcible rape. He was sentenced to 17 years in prison. Eric Nunes pleaded guilty to sexual battery. Under his deal, he would serve 10 years. At Darren's federal sentencing, Judge Malazzo told Darren that she couldn't understand why he did what he did, calling him college-educated, and said that he had grown up in one of the most loving households. Darren spoke to the court while sobbing and said that he would like to apologize 1,000 times. Quote, "I'm still trying to figure out why I made some of these choices. I lived my life right for 38 years. Then I took this path." Through tears, he promised his family, who were there in court, that he would make it up to them. One of his victims, the former Saints cheerleader, also spoke in court, crying and saying that she understands that people make mistakes, but that this wasn't a mistake. It was a way of life for him and his friends. She said that after Darren attacked her, she took medication to prevent potential HIV infections and that she couldn't brush her teeth without getting nauseous. She said she needed her mom to sleep next to her at night or else she couldn't fall asleep. She said she hopes that no one ever treats Darren's own daughter this way. Judge Malazzo said that what happened to the victims was the worst nightmare for any parent of a daughter. She then sentenced him to 18 years and 4 months in prison and fined him $20,000. He was to be on 3 years supervised release after he gets out of prison and must register as a sex offender. Darren was also sentenced in Arizona, California, Nevada, and Louisiana per the terms of his global plea deal, including the lifetime probation in Arizona upon his release. At his sentencing hearing in Los Angeles, another victim spoke out, telling Darren that he has a sickness and that he deserves far more punishment than what he got. Darren spoke again too, again apologizing to his victims and also addressing his family. "There's a lot more to my life than this situation," he said. "I am not a monster. I am not." But even though Darren pleaded guilty and apologized to his victims and to his family in court, he wasn't done fighting for a more lenient sentence. He appealed his federal sentence, saying that his guilty plea was involuntary, that he didn't have any other choice after Judge Malazzo rejected his initial plea deal, and that his punishment was improperly calculated. He said Judge Malazzo was wrong to take into account the other alleged cases that he hadn't been charged with. But a federal appeals court dismissed his appeal. His sentence would stand. And so now Darren Sharper, once an NFL Super Bowl champion with the New Orleans Saints, and once a man who seemed like he had it all, is now serving time in a federal prison, now tarnished as a serial rapist.
This is one that I hope isn't forgotten when people talk about, you know, Bill Cosby's case possibly being, you know, if it's an outlier or anything like that. And I don't think anybody does, but I mean, certainly when you're analyzing this situation where a celebrity may be accused of incapacitating a victim and sexually assaulting them, that, you know, that people don't look at Bill Cosby case or even this one as a vacuum, that they're looked at together.
I asked Ramon if he had anything else to add about this case or what his takeaways were.
It certainly exposed how difficult it can be on law enforcement if an offender attacks across jurisdictions and many jurisdictions in a short amount of time. So it shows, I think, the importance, I think the lasting legacy of this case is it just shows the importance of using that for law enforcement to use, you know, all of the tools in their toolbox at their disposal when it comes to investigating cases that involve one sexual assault or serial sexual assault as well. And I think people did, you know, and when you had kind of, even if there were record conversations off the record with some of the investigators that were involved, it seems like that was a takeaway.
While Darren's in prison, his legal problems aren't over yet. He is also currently being sued by multiple victims, alleging assault and battery, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and civil conspiracy. And that's all for today's episode. A special thank you to Ramon Antonio Vargas from the New Orleans Advocate for helping me out with this case. You can follow Ramon on Twitter at rvargasadvocate, or you can email him at rvargas@theadvocate.com. I'll add these in the show notes for you as well. And I want to know what you think about this case. Do you think Darren's plea deal was too lenient? What are your thoughts on the penile monitoring system that he may be subjected to once he's released? And do you think that there may be more victims out there who haven't spoken out yet? Let me know by joining my discussion group on Facebook. Just go to courtjunkie.com/Facebook. You can also tweet me at courtjunkiepod, follow me on Instagram at courtjunkie, or email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. And just a reminder, if you don't like hearing the ads in these episodes, I have a solution for you. For as little as $1 a month, you can get access to these episodes early and ad-free. Just go to courtjunkie.com/support, which will redirect you to my Patreon page. Signing up is super easy, and once you do, you'll have access to an exclusive RSS feed that you can add to many podcast listening apps, including Apple Podcasts. You can also listen right on Patreon's website or through their app. That's courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Until next time.